From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Puerto Rico's debt crisis has taken a dramatic turn after the island suspended debt repayments. A U.S. government plan to resolve the situation is stuck in limbo after months of negotiations. CCTV's business correspondent Owen Fairclough filed this report from Washington, D.C.
A Caribbean island that spent years on borrowed time and money is finally out of both. The government says it can no longer afford to repay $72 billion in debts. It also can't afford to cover $45 billion in pension liabilities. And that debt pile is forecast to grow by nearly $30 billion in the next 5 years. Unlike mainland states, Puerto Rico can't declare bankruptcy to wipe the financial slate clean. A bailout has also been ruled out. The US government is now considering taking the reins through a financial control board, used to rescue bankrupted cities like Detroit and Washington. Taking over Puerto Rico's finances raises questions about its identity as a US territory with limited independence. Puerto Ricans can't even vote for president.
There's a big portion of the population of Puerto Rico that is more of an anti-colonial movement, as they will label themselves, and they really don't like having any authority from the U.S. over Puerto Rico. They would like to become independent.
Ultimately, the toughest decision is likely to be who loses: investors who bought the island's debt or Puerto Rican pensioners and public service users.
There are going to be losses, and there will be a big negotiation around how the losses are shared.
It now looks increasingly likely the U.S. government will be making those decisions for an island long on Spirit, but short of options. Owen Fairclough, CCTV, Washington.
A Turkish parliamentary committee has approved a bill that strips legislators of immunity from prosecution, paving the way for the filing of terror-related charges against several Kurdish members of parliament who have been critical of the military attacks by that country's president against Kurdish communities across the country. CCTV's Edwin Marr has more.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has accused members of the People's Democratic Party of being an arm of the outlawed PKK. A brawl broke out between members of Erdogan's ruling AK party and the PDP as the committee debated the draft law. Legislators hurled bottled water at each other across the meeting room, forcing the committee head to halt proceedings. The vote comes amid a surge of violence in Turkey's southeast after a fragile peace process with the rebels collapsed.
The Ankara government said Monday that authorities have foiled more than 80 planned attacks in the country since January and stepped up anti-terrorism efforts. This was Turkey's Deputy Prime Minister Numan Kurtulmus at a press conference Monday.
From January until now, there have been a large number of foiled attacks. I don't want to explain them one by one. We have our notes. I would just like to announce the figures. 85 significant incidents were prevented through prior intelligence. 49 of them were suicide bombers or bomb-loaded vehicles and cars. So the fact that the planned attacks were foiled is being evaluated as a magnificent and important measure to fight against terrorism.
Two important trade treaties currently under negotiation by the U.S. government: the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TTP, with its focus towards Asia, and TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, focused towards Europe, have each taken a major hit in the past few days. In an editorial published Tuesday in the Washington Post, President Barack Obama stumped for the TPP, that beleaguered set of talks that has become a symbol of what's wrong with the U.S. economy among supporters of both Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Bernie Sanders. Long favored by Democrat Hillary Clinton and the establishment elite in both the Democratic and Republican parties, President Obama made it clear that he sees the TPP as a weapon aimed at China, writing that the Asia-Pacific region would continue its economic integration with or without the United States. America said the president should, quote, write the rules. America should call the shots. Other countries should play by the rules that America and our partners set, and not the other way around, closed quote. RT's Andrew Farmer has more.
President Barack Obama says the world should play by America's rules, words he used to explain how the Trans-Pacific Partnership would keep the US as the world's global trade leader. The TPP is a trade deal which involves 12 countries and 40% of the world's economy. It was signed in February this year, but the member states still have 2 years to ratify or reject the agreement. However, the deal has been heavily criticised for being negotiated behind closed doors. Experts also say the TTP is a tool for America to hold off its main competitor, China, which is not included in the agreement spanning large parts of Asia.
As for TTIP, the leaked text of secret negotiations in that proposed EU-US deal indicate that it could destroy long-held environmental and consumer protections that many Europeans hold dear. Greenpeace Netherlands published classified documents Monday, lifting the veil of secrecy that's defined the negotiations over the proposed agreement, revealing the project's deep implications for climate protection, jobs, food safety, human health, workers' rights, privacy rights, and the very social fabric of Europe itself. The executive director of UK social justice campaign War on Want, John Hillary, said the leak shows how TTIP poses a direct threat to the people of Europe.
What we didn't perhaps know is that the European Commission was going to play dead and just allow them to walk all over our rules, our rights and our regulations. And I think that's the most shocking side here, that we are being sold down the river by our representatives in these talks.
The systematic destruction of medical facilities, staff and patients during conflict is a violation of international law that must end. That, according to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, as he briefed the Security Council Tuesday. He was speaking after members unanimously adopted a wide-ranging resolution condemning attacks on health facilities and workers during armed conflict. Matthew Wells reports.
In Syria's brutal civil war alone, more than 360 attacks have been documented on around 250 medical facilities, killing more than 730 medical personnel, said Mr. Ban. There and in Yemen, where the UN recorded 59 attacks against 34 hospitals last year, a vicious pattern of systematic destruction simply must end, he added.
Explanations ring hollow to parents burying their children. All too often, there is no respect for the sick and no sanctity for those who provide care. All too often, attacks on health facilities and medical workers are not just isolated or incidental battlefield fallout, but rather the intended objective of the combatants. This is shameful and inexcusable.
The UN chief said that the resolution demonstrated the Council's determination to strengthen protection for the most vulnerable in war, and he urged member states to heed its demands to help humanitarians do their life-saving work, better train their soldiers, and hold violators accountable.
Even wars have rules. It is time to uphold and enforce them. The international community must never become numb to flagrant abuses.
The president of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, told the council that over the past 3 years, in 11 different conflict zones, there had been an average of 2 attacks on medical facilities every single day. Rather than just decrying the facts, he said principled pragmatism was now needed.
This resolution marks a momentous step in the international community's effort to draw attention to a problem that we otherwise risked getting used to through the sheer frequency of its occurrence. But after outrage must come action, not complacency. So while this resolution is an important step, it must not mark the end of a political process, but the beginning of a practical effort.
The most stinging and passionate contribution inside the Security Council chamber came from the International President of Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, Joanne Liu. The doctors' organisation has suffered multiple attacks on its facilities, including the obliteration, as she described it, of its hospital in Aleppo, Syria, last Wednesday. She had a particular message for permanent council members, Britain, the United States, France and Russia.
4 of the 5 permanent members of this council have, to varying degrees, been associated with coalition responsible for attacks on health structure over the last year. These include the NATO-led coalition in Afghanistan, the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, the Russia-backed Syrian-led coalition. You, therefore, must live up to your extraordinary responsibilities and set an example for all the states. I repeat, stop these attacks.
Matthew Wells, United Nations.
After the adoption of the UN Security Council resolution on healthcare and armed conflict, Ambassador Amer Abdellatif Abdullahda of Egypt was joined at a press encounter outside the council's chambers by Ambassador Motohide Yoshikawa of Japan, Ambassador Gerard Jacobus von Bohemen of New Zealand, Ambassador Roman Oyarzun Marchese of Spain, and Ambassador Elbio Rosselli of Uruguay.
Let me start by saying that the Security Council has just adopted a resolution on healthcare in armed conflict, a problem that occurs in different conflicts around the world. There are increasing attacks on healthcare workers and facilities, and growing impediment to the delivery of healthcare in a range of contemporary conflict, including several in which the UN Security Council is seized. This trend challenges core tenets of international humanitarian law aimed at minimizing the impact of conflict on civilians. I would like to allude to the unique process by which this resolution was formulated, which constitutes the first time in which five elected members from the Security Council from different regions of the world came together to formulate such a resolution. The resolution seeks to, first, send a strong and clear message from the Security Council that attacks targeting hospital and medical workers are unacceptable and will not be tolerated. Demand that all parties to armed conflicts comply fully with their international law obligations, including international humanitarian law. And lastly, urge states to ensure accountability against the perpetration of such crimes targeting healthcare facilities or healthcare personnel exclusively engaged in armed conflict, and request regular reporting by the Secretary General on this issue. I will now give the floor to my dear colleagues to make any further remark or respond to your questions.
Mr. Ambassador, on your national capacity, there was a call in the Council for an urgent meeting on Aleppo and Syria. In your national capacity, do you support that call? And there is a draft statement, probably, as a president of the Security Council. What's the status of this draft statement?
I think the briefing will be tomorrow. We're still looking with the Secretary General at what time exactly it will be. And of course, I support it, of course, like all my colleagues, I think.
And the draft?
There is still no.
Excellencies, since this has been unprecedented to have five elected members of the Council come up with the resolution, and you spoke already about the accountability. What measures or what's the mechanism for accountability for incidents that took place, especially in the Middle East, whether in Syria, in Yemen, or elsewhere, where medical facilities have been bombarded, civilians have been killed, patients have been murdered unhumanely? What is the mechanism, or it's going to be added, this resolution is going to be added to an array of other resolutions that have no teeth for implementation?
Well, I can answer that very easily. If you have a look to the resolution, OP9 and OP14 are the right answers. OP9 calls upon investigations if breaches of the resolution might happen, and OP14 calls for a reporting system by the Secretary General once a year, and that will allow us to receive exact information about all breaches that happened throughout the year.
Mr. President, did you decide when will Mr. De Mistura brief the Council, and are you preparing for any outcome on his briefing?
No, still, we are literally looking for Mr. De Mistura about, but it will be next year, in the coming few days. But no dates yet have been. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Following that announcement, the President of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, and Joanne Liu, the head of Doctors Without Borders, spoke with the press about the protection of civilians in armed conflict.
I came here today to state very clearly to the Security Council that the resolution that has just passed must not end up, like so many others, violated with impunity. Reaffirming that hospitals, health workers, patients must not be bombed or attacked is not good enough. Action must be taken to stop these attacks. Today's words will only be meaningful if they are put into practice. Seeking and providing healthcare must not be to a death sentence. Hospitals and patients must not be dragged onto the battlefield. They are not a target. I say it again and echo the UN Security General word, even wars as rules. Protecting the wounded and sick and those who care for them is the last front line for humanity in the otherwise inhuman and brutal reality of war. A strong Security Council resolution is an important statement for humanity and rule of law. But without action, this will be meaningless. The Security Council members must live up to their extraordinary responsibility and set an example for all states. This resolution must save lives. Thank you.
Let me on my side also recognize that today is an important moment for the International Committee of the Red Cross. For years we have drawn the attention of the international community to the fact that attacks on health workers, ambulances, hospitals have come from being side events of warfare to the center stage of warfare, and increasingly we have complained the systematic and endemic attacks that have grown over years and through conflicts, not only in the Middle East, but worldwide. So having the Council recognize the importance of this issue and formulating a resolution to counter these attacks is an important milestone. As you have seen, and I join Joanne Liu in the call for implementation of this resolution. I made it clear this morning in the Council as well in my speech that this resolution will be just another resolution if it is not considered to be the first step in a long process of implementation. And process of implementation means that countries have to strengthen their legislation internally in order to outlaw attacks on medical facilities and medical workers, that countries have to train their militaries in order to ensure respect for international humanitarian law, that countries have to respect by law medical ethics and to protect medical workers who work according to ethics, and they have to be mindful of arms transfers that they effectuate in war zones in order to ensure that those who get those arms do respect international humanitarian law. Why is implementation so important? Implementation is important because attacks on health facilities and health workers is not only an attack on those workers and on patients in the moment. They have a much broader impact on health systems. They destroy development gains, and they flout international humanitarian law, which is the most elementary law in armed conflict today. So instead of being particularly protected institutions and professions, health workers have become the main attacks and the main objects of attacks. This has to be stopped. It has to be stopped through working for the implementation of this resolution, but it has also to be stopped by organizations like MSF and ICRC, who are here today in a joint effort to draw the attention of the international community to this outrageous disrespect of international humanitarian law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask you if you could possibly comment to what happened in Aleppo today. There is information that a new hospital has been attacked, a number of casualties, I guess three people dead. Do you have the information, maybe any of your colleagues were working in that hospital? And also to Mrs. Liu, a question on the Kunduz incident. The U.S. ambassador today provided some sort of apologies to what happened last year, but are you satisfied with the actions taken by the U.S. government? Do you want them to go the extra mile, probably to pay money to the victims of the attack. Thank you.
Well, we haven't. We're still gathering some information about what is going on in Alep, but our first communication that we had with our head of mission in the field is word where Aleppo is burning, and it is say we just wait here, wait to die. So I don't have any more words to share with you at this stage, but I think the situation is really dramatic and something needs to happen. And I think this is why I reiterate my call to that we have to make a stop to those attacks.
Well, let me just on the first reiterate also that we are collecting information as we move forward. This just illustrates what I think many speakers this morning have said, that attacks need to be thoroughly investigated, and unfortunately they have become systematic. And this must stop. We have seen now in the Aleppo region that this basically unravels the capacity of medical services in a whole city again. And we have mentioned those examples this morning, that it's not only the singular attack on one facility, but it's the deep impact on medical services in a whole region which is at stake. I think it underlines the importance of the resolution which has been adopted today.
I was just going to ask about the Kunduz, what the U.S. said today. They, as my colleague mentioned, their representative from the U.S. appeared to apologize somewhat. I wanted to ask about that, whether you think the U.S. needs to do more in terms of an investigation. And also in the report that came out on Friday from the Pentagon, they basically declared that this was not a war crime. And they said that because they didn't mean to kill these people, these patients, that that meant it wasn't a war crime. I'm wondering what you make of that.
Well, we acknowledge, you know, the apologies reiterated by the ambassador of the U.S. Today in the meeting. And with respect to the report, the U.S., you know, has admitted that it was a breach to international humanitarian law publicly. And so for us, you know, we still reiterate that we find it very difficult that someone will be the perpetrator, the judge, the investigator, and the jury.
Can you please clarify how many hospitals in Syria and in Yemen of Médecins Sans Frontières are still operating in full capacity?
Well, in terms of we're working in 8 different sites in Yemen, and then we are supporting healthcare facilities in those different sites, and then in Syria we are supporting more than 150 facilities, but we have very close connection and working with staff in 6 hospitals in the northern part of Syria.
Guess a question on Yemen. Sorry, and I'm sorry if you've answered it. The door was locked, so there was some delay. But I wanted to ask, after the Saudi-led coalition's bombing or a seeming airstrike on the clinic in Sada'a, and I believe there was one in Taiz also hit, do you think that the steps taken by the coalition to investigate those strikes comply with this resolution in terms of accountability? I heard one of the ambassadors going in said that the coalition has a mechanism in place, and this was somehow what distinguishes them, let's say, from the Syrian government. Do you feel, what's your conclusion on their own investigation, and have you reopened in Sada'a? What's the status of healthcare in the northern part of Yemen where there have been a lot of those strikes?
So with respect to the question about the investigation, it's been an investigation that was basically led by the Saudians. And again, you know, I think that we've been clear on our ask for an independent and impartial investigation. So again, I repeat, I don't think you can be a perpetrator and as well an investigator, a jury, and a judge. So in that respect, I don't think I can add much more. With respect to what we do in the northern part, our facilities have been struck. It was facilities that we were supporting. But we still work in the northern part of Yemen, but it's always a very, I would say, challenging working environment.
Thank you.
And we close today's newscast with some commentary from imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, looking at the relationship between President Obama and the Black Lives Matter movement, and President Obama and the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Obama versus BLM, MLK versus Obama. On his latest trek to Britain, U.S. President Barack Hussein Obama took a slap at the youthful activists of the Black Lives Matter movement. They were really effective at bringing attention to serious issues, he said, but they failed by not sitting down with political leaders. You can't just keep yelling at them, he chided. Obama's chastisement of the movement then portrayed them as immature, unsophisticated, and unknowledgeable about the mysterious ways of politics, which, in his view, was about sitting down and making deals. This is more than ironic, coming from a president who hasn't been able to meet with a plethora of politicians who oppose him. Guess who else was criticized because he organized protests? Yes, Dr. Martin Luther King, who in his book, Why We Can't Wait, wrote, "We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well-timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see, with one of our distinguished jurists, that justice too long delayed is justice denied." These words from his 1963 letter from a Birmingham jail go on to describe hate-filled policemen, again, King's words, who, he writes, curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters. It is that continuing crisis that gave birth to Black Lives Matter, not their political naivete. By the way, Black Lives Matter have done far more than yell at politicians. Their efforts led to the electoral defeat of at least two prosecutors who spit on the community and the aftermath of the police killings of Laquan McDonald in Obama's hometown, Chicago, and in Ferguson, Missouri. They have raised the flag of black resistance to injustice. Should they have sat down and quietly discussed matters with Obama's homie, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel? Emanuel, whose contempt for black life is legendary? Who helped cover up McDonald's murder by police? Yeah, good luck with that. Black Lives Matter's yelling ain't the problem. Far too often, the problem is politicians who make deals why black people die. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.